This is Piedmont Arts. He was a drunk, had been arrested countless times, and even committed murder. But Michelangelo Merisi da Caravaggio was also a revolutionary and influential painter of the late 16th century in Rome, Naples, and Sicily. Hi, I'm Phil Vavra. A new exhibition of Caravaggio's paintings and others by leading Baroque masters has opened at the Mint Museum in Uptown Charlotte. Our colleague Dan Dreyer spoke with exhibition curator and Mint president and CEO Todd Herman. Later in this episode, we'll hear from Jude Lynn Gibson about this year's Spoleto USA Festival in Charleston, South Carolina. And I'll fill you in on some other fun events happening across our region with fanfare. Thanks for listening.
Why is it important that Charlotte has acquired this opportunity to see so many of these works?
Well, this is the first time that this collection, which comes from the Longhi Foundation just outside of Florence, this is the first time that it has been in the U.S. So there were two venues here, St. Petersburg, Florida, and the Mint Museum. And the reason that it is here in the Mint is because I think, you know, it's a very interesting look at not just Caravaggio, but also the connection between art history, connoisseurship, and the artist himself, right? So how do artists like Caravaggio, who today we people flock to see Caravaggio paintings, right? So how is it that there was a time when you could have bought a Caravaggio for very little money, because he was so out of favor? I mean, it's almost hard to believe these days.
So take us to a piece that stands out for you, maybe a favorite or one that would really explain visually everything that you're telling us right now.
Okay, well, obviously, the one painting which is the star is Caravaggio's Boy Bitten by a Lizard. And that is in the first gallery of the exhibition. And this first gallery is really a way for you to kind of get a sense of Caravaggio's style, his influences, what else is going on at the same time in Rome, and a little bit into kind of particularly his early career. So this painting, Boy Bitten by a Lizard, was painted at the end of the 16th century. So he has just arrived in Rome from Milan, where he grew up and studied in some artists' workshops, right? And we know who they are, but he was never in a workshop for very long. When he arrives in Rome, he's a young man. He's in his early 20s. He has sort of no real prospects. Right, so he has studied with a few minor artists in and around Milan, but he goes to Rome because Rome is where the action is. Rome is where the papacy is, the cardinals. You know, there's a lot of opportunity for a young artist to earn a living in Rome. He was painting these kind of images that he could sell on the street. Right, so it wasn't one specific religious scene or one specific saint that would make a purchaser or a potential purchaser say, oh, well, that's not my patron saint, you know, so I don't want to buy. So he made something sort of general, generic. So selling those on the street, sort of hawking them on the street, was sort of the lowest level that an artist could have, right? He didn't have a patron, he didn't have a protector, so he just had to do what he could to sell his wares. Within a very short time, and I'm talking 5 years in Rome, he has gone from hawking his paintings on the street to anyone who will buy them at discount prices, right? To young artists copying his work and selling it to a rabid audience who want his paintings, because he is now, 5 years later, the most popular painter in all of Rome.
And what was it that made that jump from basically selling anything, hawking your word, to now everybody's copying him, and now he's got competition because somebody else might be doing like a fake Caravaggio?
Well, exactly. And what was so revolutionary about him was his style, right? So yes, he did eventually have a patron who helped sort of promote him, but that wouldn't have happened if his style didn't lead the way, and his style was truly revolutionary. So what he brought to art in Rome at that time was drama, dramatic lighting, dark, inky backgrounds, and then a spotlight on the figure taking center stage in the middle of the picture frame, and then a reality that had, as of yet, not been seen in Rome. And by reality, I mean when we look at these paintings like Boy Peeling Fruit or Boy Bitten by a Lizard, we get the sense that these young men actually are walking the streets of Rome, right? And Caravaggio just goes out and says, hey, come in here and, you know, sit for me while I make this painting, which is in fact largely what happened, right? He gives you gritty, raw naturalism.
Confrontational, I would say.
It is confrontational. And so you had some people in Rome say, oh my gosh, finally, right? Particularly young artists, finally, we're seeing reality. Finally, we're seeing, like, this is a way where these, particularly in religious paintings, we get the sense that these figures actually existed. Right? They had dirty fingernails. They had dirty feet. They might have had a goiter, right? Whereas someone like Raphael would have certainly cleaned all of that up, right? And made it, super idealized. But Caravaggio gives you who they are so that you get to relate to them as a real person.
So in this painting, Boy Bitten by a Serpent, tell us, as you look at this painting, give us the examples that you see. Maybe describe what the painting is first off, what's showing, and then amplify what you're saying here about his style.
Okay. So we have in this painting a boy probably in his early teens, maybe, wearing sort of a pseudo-historic garment. So it's not really a shirt. It's not like a historic toga. It's sort of a series of pieces of wrapped cloth sort of around him. Off his one shoulder, he has a flower behind his ear, and we see in front of him
full head of hair. You can't let that go.
A very full head of hair. I am extremely jealous of what I'm seeing in this painting. Okay. And on the ledge in front of him, we have a still life, which includes fruits and a glass vase with some flowers in it. And in that vase, if you look very closely, you will see the reflection of the room that they're in with the window. And through the window, you see a building. That's on the ledge in front of him. And then as the young man is reaching his hand forward, a lizard comes up out of the still life and bites his middle finger. And he recoils, right, with a furrowed brow and his mouth partly open, and he's looking straight out at you with this sort of pained expression, this expression of both pain and surprise. And so where we see Caravaggio here is we have a very plain background, nondescript, but a dramatic, strong light hitting the side of the boy's face, hitting his shoulder, hitting his hand, highlighting the glass vase, and then throwing the rest sort of into a shadow. And that just heightens the drama of his reaction. On its surface, it is just a beautiful, captivating painting. And when you come into this room, you can't help but notice how it sort of leaps off the wall compared to all the other paintings that are in here. The influence of Caravaggio is wildly outsized to, number one, his output, and number two, the length of his career. So this just tells you how revolutionary it was, that even though a lot was stacked against him, he still managed to influence Western art like no other artist has. And there's a famous statement, which I think sums it up, about Caravaggio, and that is, there was painting before Caravaggio, and there was painting after Caravaggio, and they are not the same.
So among the artists here who would have been influenced by Caravaggio, stretch this out a little bit farther. Who would Bruegel have been one who had been influenced? I mean, who are other names that folks that aren't as adept at you at art history would recognize and say, wow, I never thought about that Caravaggio would have influenced?
Rembrandt.
Yeah.
Rembrandt, for sure.
Yeah.
I don't think the Rembrandt that we know would exist without Caravaggio first.
It seems hard to separate Caravaggio's criminal life, his violent life, his vibrant life, and a whole host of other sentences from the art, from what we see in the art. Is that a fair statement to make?
You know, it is fair, but I think it's unfair to Caravaggio that this happens, because there are many artists in the history of art that have personal lives that we might find unsavory. I think because he had some deep detractors at the time, so we're talking about, you know, we were talking earlier about artists, particularly younger artists, who were completely enamored by this new style that he brought to Rome. But then there were plenty of artists and patrons who rejected it.
What would you like viewers and visitors to take away from this exhibition?
Just that, you know, one artist made an enormous difference in Western painting. I mean, here he was troubled. I mean, let's not deny, you know, that he had a rough life, largely of his own making, right? And yet he produced not just beautiful paintings and innovative paintings, but also there's a depth to them in the sense that he could take subject matter that had been painted for hundreds of years, and he could find a new way to present it that was different from what anyone had ever done before. And again, as we've been saying, you either loved it or you hated it. There was very few, like, in between. Even some of the artists, some of his fellow artists at the time who really did not like his art, and certainly did not like him, they made that obvious, respected what he was doing and what he was able to accomplish.
Todd, thank you for showing us around today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Caravaggio Revolution, Baroque Masterpieces from the Roberto Longhi Foundation, is on view until late October at the Mint Museum in Charlotte. Todd Herman, the exhibition curator and Mint CEO, spoke with our colleague Dan Dreyer. Coming up, we'll check in with Judelyn Gibson about Spoleto USA, happening over in Charleston, South Carolina. Right now, though, let's see what else is going on across our region with Fanfare. We have another fun week ahead of us, with a couple of events from the CSO and the final weekend of the Charlotte Bach Festival, plus there's moonshine and liver mush on the menu. The Charlotte Symphony Orchestra is bringing Ryan Coogler's 2018 Marvel masterpiece Black Panther to the big screen at Belk Theater this Friday and Saturday at 7:30. The CSO performs the Grammy-winning score live on stage along with the entire feature-length film. Bach Charlotte's annual Charlotte Bach Festival winds down this weekend with Echoes of Bach, featuring works by Poulenc, Satie, Rameau, and Franck at St. Mark's Lutheran Church on Friday at 7:30. Then it's Handel's powerful three-act oratorio, Theodora, at the Sandra Levine Theater, Gambrell Center, Queen's University of Charlotte on Saturday at 7:30. The festival concludes with organist Lester Ackerman performing at St. Mark's Lutheran Church on Sunday, June 7th at 3 p.m. The Little Theater of Winston-Salem presents the hilarious musical adventure The Mystery of Edwin Drood at Hanesbrands Theater June 5th through 21st. This beloved show by Rupert Holmes, if you like pina coladas, yeah, that guy, lets you choose the ending as a quirky Victorian theater troupe brings Charles Dickens' unfinished novel to life with plenty of laughs and catchy tunes. The Charlotte Symphony Orchestra returns to Symphony Park to kick off its annual Summer Pop Series on Sunday, June 7th at 8:15. The 2026 edition begins with American Classics, featuring popular works by composers from across the U.S. Don't forget your chairs, blankets, and picnic baskets. Jazz luminary Branford Marsalis returns to Brevard Music Center's Whittington Fole Auditorium in Brevard on Thursday, June 11th at 7:30. The saxophonist joins the BMC's all-star faculty and students for a swinging night of beloved tunes and timeless standards. Charlotte Ballet is bringing Flip back to the Patricia McBride and Jean-Pierre Bonfou Center for Dance June 11th through the 20th. The stage becomes a canvas as Charlotte Ballet's professional dancers present a bold, playful, and deeply personal performance entirely of their own creation. The Cherry Bounce Festival on June 5th and 6th features live bluegrass and Americana music, local and regional art, as well as moonshine and cherry-inspired items from restaurants and businesses in Forest City. And people either love Livermush or hate it. For the record, I love it. But every year, the town of Marion celebrates the Appalachian delicacy with its own Livermush Festival. The 18th annual edition offers live music, craft vendors, hog calling and pig squealing contests, and plenty of food. And that's on Saturday the 6th. Find even more to see, do, and eat on my complete fanfare column at WDAV.org. And fanfare is made possible in part by Bragg Financial. It's summer festival season in the Carolinas, and the first big one we're looking at is Spoleto USA in Charleston, which is now underway and goes through June 7th. This year, the Spoleto USA Festival Chorus has a brand new music director. Our colleague Judelyn Gibson tells us more.
Dr. Amanda Quist of Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo is in her first year as music director of the Spoleto USA Festival Chorus. When we talked, she was packing to leave the next day.
It's something that's kind of mountaintop, you know, to be with this group of singers. It's a real gift. And so I thought, well, let's just give it a shot. I'm not retired yet, so here we go. You know, I have a huge list of things to do in my mind, of course, but I'm excited because I've been to Spoleto. I know what it feels like, and I'm excited to be now part of the artistic side of things. So mostly just excitement, and then, of course, a constant spinning to-do list in the background.
Dr. Quist has a big job ahead, the largest of which is a series of choral concerts.
So then the chorus and I get together and we spend several days rehearsing. And then we have two performances at St. Matthew's Church. And that's just all choir, just our own music that we're doing. And that's the one that's called storytelling. And that's the last thing we're doing.
She put a lot of thought into curating the storytelling program in celebration of the 250th anniversary of America.
I wanted to lean into the theme of storytelling because if you think about America and you say, what's the American story? It's all over the place. There's so many different experiences, positive and struggle and everything in between. And so I thought it would be interesting to pull some pieces together that tell some aspects of the stories of people who either are Americans or were written by American composers or are just related, American adjacent. So the program is going to have just four sets. The first set is going to be called Invocation. And this is sort of an invitation to join us sonically. And the first piece we sing, it's in Latin, and the text means arise and come with us, come away. The first piece I chose is actually kind of an early Baroque motet by a female composer. And I chose it first and foremost because it's beautiful, but also because this was the first female composer to ever have her sacred music published in the history of all time. Vittoria Aliotti, who's an Italian woman composer, and she was the first one to have it actually go into a collection and be printed. She's significant for that reason. And I looked up, you know, I was looking for something to open the program. Sonically, it's the perfect piece to open the program because it's double choir, it's big, it's rich, it's explosive. But I wanted to tie it to our theme and the story of her struggle of being an incredible composer, but not getting a platform and how she overcame that was interesting to me, because at the exact same time, you know, she's in Europe, in Italy, at the exact same time, there were these European settlers in what is now the United States fighting with the Native Americans, which is really interesting. So that what we're going to follow the Aliotti with is a Native American hymn, a Muscogee Creek hymn called Hallelujah. So I wanted to start with kind of two pieces that represented maybe some sort of beginning, some sort of struggle, but some sort of call to come with us on this journey. Because then the next set is called Revolution. And it's really about war and how war affects us. So the first piece is by William Billings, and it's called Chester. And it was written specifically for the American Revolution. The first line people might be familiar with, it's "Let tyrants shake their iron rod," is the text people know, but it's named Chester. They often named pieces after towns, maybe they were composed in or whatever it is. But it was a very famous hymn. And if you've ever heard like a singing society, an American singing society or Shaker hymns or anything like that, it's got that kind of raw, early American, somewhat untrained kind of sound that we'll go for. And again, written for the Revolutionary War. Then we're going to go from there. And this is kind of the idea of the program, is to look at something kind of in with a magnifying glass and then back up and think about, okay, what is the humanity behind this? So this is very, you know, of the time. Then we zoom out and we do Thomas Wilkes' When David Heard, which is a Renaissance motet about when David hears that his son, Absalom, is killed at battle and how he responds to that. And so it's just about how people deal with the loss of life in war. And it's the most beautiful motet. It's written in such a symbolic way. You can hear the pain in the music. There's lots of dissonance and resolution as you hear him crying over the loss of his son and finding this out. And then we go from there to another piece about the loss of life, but it is the voice of the soldier. And it's called The Dying Soldier. It's arranged by Nigel Short, who's a contemporary composer, but it's kind of an older American folk song. And this is about this man giving the words while he's dying on the battlefield. And he talks about, you know, "I am shot and bleeding. Please tell my wife and my children that I love them." So again, zooming back into a very visceral moment of an individual as opposed to thinking, you know, in the bigger picture. So that's kind of the opening set after we welcome everybody.
That's a big show.
Yeah, that's just, those are the kind of the first half. But then we go forward and we're going to a section called Dreams Deferred. And this is going to be kind of composers now responding to, you know, what America is supposed to be, or, you know, the land of the free, the home of the brave. And then you kind of sometimes go, well, I mean, are we, you know? So rather than get super political, I just thought, well, let's just tell some stories of some composers and how they've responded to different aspects of what we've experienced over the last 250 years. So the first one is Joel Thompson. And he wrote a piece called Hold Fast to Dreams. And his piece is taking a Langston Hughes poem, and he then takes a little part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, "I Have a Dream," and he puts them together into one piece of music called Hold Fast to Dreams. And so it begins with free at last, question mark. And then it goes into this whole, you know, what happens to a dream deferred, hold fast to dreams for when dreams die. You know, and then the very last word of the piece is just dream with an exclamation point. So it's very... very much kind of questioning, you know, where are we and how do we go forward? It's very visceral like that. Each word is painted by Joel. It's with piano and it's really incredible music. So that's going to open this set. The one after Joel Thompson is actually another African-American composer, Ayanna Woods. And Ayanna Woods is a fairly new name on the scene, but a big one. She's really doing amazing things. She writes in a lot of different genres and she is herself a performer. So she was commissioned by The Crossing to write a piece called Shift. And we're going to take the second movement of Shift. And she writes it with electronics. And so if you know what a looper is, you can sort of make a sound, record it, and then play it back, and then sing along with your own looped recording. So we're not going to actually do the looping, but we're going to make the sound of the looping with the choir. Because the text of this one, I just want to share with you because of what comes after it. So this is Iana Woods. This is Shift. And part of the text says, why do we build monuments in stone? Stone is brittle when it cracks. It cuts to your churning core. America, tectonic plates collide. You shift in your seat. And then the last part of the poem is, I want a monument we imagine and reimagine, a monument we grasp and heave and pull in a long arc bursting through the cracks in the story you tell, America. And then I go from that to Her Beacon Hand by Caroline Shaw, which is from her larger work To the Hands, which was also commissioned by The Crossing. And this is kind of a response to the poem that's written on the base of the Statue of Liberty. And so thinking of monuments, right? And so that it opens, Her Beacon Hand beckons. And that has to do with the Statue of Liberty. Most people know Elijah Rock. But I wanted to include something that was a spiritual, because that's been so much a part of the fabric of choral music in America for the last many years. And so we'll close that set with Moses Hogan.
And you've got Joni Mitchell in there.
Our last set is Love and Transcendence. So we'll have Joni Mitchell's Both Sides Now, arranged for choir by Tim Brent, who's actually my husband and a well-known composer. And then we'll do Shall We Gather at the River, a famous folk song by Blake Morgan. It's beautiful, beautiful arrangement. And then we'll finish with I'll Be On My Way by Sean Kirchner, which is an American, a living American composer. Again, very much folk song style. It's about transcending. It's actually about dying and what might happen when we're gone. You know, and in Sean's view, it's heaven. But depending on the person, you know, he doesn't name it exactly. So each person can kind of imagine their own experience through the transcendence at the end of the program.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot, but we wanted to try and grab as many aspects of the American story as we could in, you know, 80 minutes of music.
You heard Dr. Quist mention that some of the music was commissioned by The Crossing. It's a Philadelphia-based Grammy-winning chamber choir whose entire repertoire is new music that they commission. The Spoleto USA Festival Chorus sings the storytelling program on June 5th and 6th. I've been speaking with Dr. Amanda Quist, music director of the Spoleto USA Festival Chorus.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Spoleto USA runs through June 7th in Charleston. The other Carolina summer festivals get underway in June. The Brevard Music Center Summer Institute and Festival starts June 11th. They're celebrating the 90th year of the festival. Over in Boone, an Appalachian Summer Festival opens on June 27th. For Piedmont Arts, I'm Judlyn Gibson.
Thanks for listening to Piedmont Arts. You can hear more of our episodes and subscribe so you never miss one at wdav.org/podcasts. Apple Podcasts, and iHeart Podcasts. For Piedmont Arts, I'm Phil Vavra.